has ceased fire, has claimed victory. What does your brain go through?
Well, again, it's interesting. I mean, the Bush administration was objecting to a ceasefire, immediate halt to hostilities, because they said they wanted a permanent ceasefire. But what was interesting is that they defined that as disarming Hezbollah, which made it seem like the whole cause of this conflict was the fact that Hezbollah was armed, when that may be a significant problem in the conflict, but it is not the source of the conflict. You have to ask, why do they exist? And Hezbollah, I think a lot of people don't realize, and I think the media did not really expose, has very deep roots, social roots, in southern Lebanon. I mean, they are, in many ways, a social service organization. I'm not saying that's all they are, but they have attracted a lot of local support, because if someone loses their job, groceries show up on their doorstep the next day, courtesy of Hezbollah. Now that the fighting is over, Hezbollah has already been handing out checks for, you know, compensating people for the loss of their property and doing other things to help compensate and ease people's return back to their homes. So the underlying dynamic in Lebanon, we haven't dealt with at all. I mean, we're making provisions to try to keep a lid on the active violence, and that's a good thing. What we need, though, is a much deeper sort of holistic kind of support for Lebanon as a country that is trying to make a transition to democracy, but it's a weak government, uncharacteristically so at this stage of its development, and they need a lot of support, economic as well as political, and also for sort of social services and things. But what we need to see the international community do is to bring those things in. But unfortunately, the media's attention tends to wane once the troops are not there, the bombs are not falling, and the rockets are not being fired. So the question really is the staying power of the media's attention and sort of the depth of that attention, that it's not just focused on the presence of violence, how many casualties were there in a particular day, but is actually dealing with some of the deeper problems that affect Lebanon and affect Israel.
And that's what you were talking about earlier with me about the many different forms that take place in the peace process, and the different agents that help with that.
Right. I mean, when we talk about peace process, it's not just the negotiation process. It's the process of rebuilding the structures within the society, rebuilding the social fabric in the society or between the societies, helping the leaders in those countries, both the national level leaders as well as the local leaders, deal with their conflicts nonviolently, so that when there is a difference of opinion, a dispute, if someone feels threatened, we don't want the first response to be to engage in violence, right? That's what we're trying to prevent, and we need to strengthen people's ability to deal with these questions in nonviolent ways.
Thank you so much for talking with us today.
You're welcome.
That's it for Sprouts. You've been listening to Protest, Profit, and Peace with guests Helena White, Mike Wyatt, Jody Dodd, and Robert Ricigliano. Sprouts is distributed by Pacifica Radio Network. Thanks to Michael Yoshida at Satellite Operations. If you or someone at your station has a radio production that you wish to rebroadcast on Sprouts to showcase it nationally, contact our air traffic controller, Ursula Rudenberg, at ursula@pacifica.org. That's ursula@pacifica.org. This week's producer was MJ LaPlay, with assistance from Nathan Moore. I'm Sarah Brown at WORT Community Radio in Madison, Wisconsin. See you next week on Sprouts.
And coming up next on Free Radio Santa Cruz, streaming, I think, and probably not broadcasting, but you can always call in anyway, 427-3772. It's Bathrop Spears Broadsides, and the show will be archived so folks can hear it later when they want. Stay tuned.
The pilot's playing poker in the cockpit of the plane. the casualties are rising like the dropping of the rain. And a mountain of machinery will fall before a man when your white boots marching in a yellow land. It's written in the ashes of the village towns we burned. It's written in the empty beds of fathers unreturned. And the chocolate in the children's eyes will never understand when your white boots marching in a yellow land. Red blow the bugles of the dawn. The morning has arrived, you must be gone. And the lost patrol chase their chartered soul like old whore following tired army. Train them well, the men who will be fighting by your side, and never turn your back if the battle turns the tide. For the colors of a civil war are louder than commands when your white boots marching in a yellow land. Blow them from the forest and burn them from your side. Tie their hands behind their backs and question through the night. But when the firing squad is ready, they'll be spitting where they stand at the white boots marching in a yellow land. Red glow the bugles of the dawn. The morning has arrived, you must be gone. And the lost patrol chase their chartered souls like old whore following tired army. The comic and the beauty queen are dancing on the stage. Raw recruits are lining up like coffins in a cage. Oh, we're fighting in a war we lost before the war began. We're the white boots marching in a yellow land. Chase the chartered souls like old whores following tired army.
And welcome to Bathrobe's Pierre's Broadsides. I'm Robert Norris. This is the October 19th, 2006 show, and as I said, it's probably streaming rather than broadcasting, because I sense there's a, that's what I catch from catching the monitor in the studio. You're still welcome to call in, as I mentioned before, if you are able to pick us up on the stream. If you're listening to this later, thank you for taking the time to go over these old shows, because by now that this show will be old. I was up on campus today at UCSC as part of the volunteer fair, staffing a table for HUF, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, the civil rights group I work with, along with Tenderfoot Tim and Bashful Bernard and Troublesome Thomas and numerous other folks kind of helping out, all of us helping out. We were putting out literature showing the UCSC students the evils of the university's sleeping ban, because not only does Santa Cruz, the city, have a sleeping ban, but the actual university has its very own sleeping ban. I wrote an article about it for the City on a Hill Press, the newspaper that the students publish in and print and edit and so forth, about 6 years ago. And I haven't really updated the story. We kind of rushed out a flyer about it And I think I'll just sort of read that for students who don't know about this, who happen to be listening to this stream, or perhaps later on want to get some more information. This is from the writing on the wall from a September 2000 City on the Hill Press. Not sure which one. I don't think there were too many City on the Hill Presses in September of 2000. They usually start with one issue or maybe two issues in that month. The city of Santa Cruz, this again was written 6 years ago, but it's still true, has a population of 55,000 with a particularly famous law, which activists have been fighting for decades, which specifically criminalizes the act of sleeping outside itself and of covering up with blankets. Directed against hippies, hobos, and the homeless, the sleeping ban, Municipal Code 6.36010A, empowers the police to ticket, arrest, harass, search, interrogate, and essentially deport any criminal sleeper homeless person they find outside between 11 p.m. and 8:30 a.m. Sleeping and covering up with blankets during those fatal hours becomes a $90 offense for the homeless people within city limits as well as for people passing through. In the much larger county area, population 230,000, sleeping in vehicles or on public lands adjacent to roads as well as parks and beaches is also forbidden. The restrictions are looser on sleeping on private property with the permission of the owner. Why don't the homeless just go to the shelters? During the non-winter months, the shelter list is always full, space for 28 on the floors of churches. And during the winter, it is often full, space for 100 on the floor of the armory and 56 in the churches. There are longer-term programs such as the 32-bed River Street Shelter and now the Reveille Family Shelter Program and the Page Smith Community House. But generally, 97% of the homeless population becomes illegal at 11 p.m. each night, 8 months of the year. Why doesn't City Council change the law? Candidates who talk progressive at election time become queerly conservative once they're in office. UCSC, half of which is in the city jurisdiction, even has its own campus sleeping ban. UCSC Ordinance 51, which is even more sweeping than the city's ban, titled Sleeping in Vehicles, it reads, during hours of darkness, no person shall sleep in any vehicle parked on campus. Special exception may be made by the university police. UC law covers the entire night, not just after 11 p.m. as the city's law does, and mandates an explicit police state-style enforcement. The UC police can pick and choose who they want to target and don't have to give a reason. UCSC ordinance sounds a bit like the current state of the law nationally, doesn't it? UCSC Ordinance 57, camping on UCSC property, uses the same language and has the same 11 to 8:30 a.m. prohibition as the city's sleeping ban. Sleeping is prohibited as well as camping. Written into UCSC Ordinance 57 is the same police state exception where the UCSC police chief can give prior permission to whoever he chooses to exempt. A police state is a state where police make the rules and choices instead of the legislators. The police exceptions to both these UC ordinances, as well as the sweeping nature of the city ordinance, reveals the real constituency behind the laws, the police themselves. Only the SCBD took an early public stand against changing the sleeping ban in 1998. Earlier, police politicked against the safe zones by telling business owners they were powerless to enforce laws, and a flat untruth. Police naturally prefer to have more power to question people, and since everyone must sleep at night, police will always have probable cause to interrogate a homeless person they find sleeping after 11 p.m., as innocent as that behavior may be. Banning sleeping takes on special significance in the midst of a housing crisis. University expansion without adequate university housing has created some of the homeless population that now faces tickets on and off campus. The plague of profiteering, rent speculation, and conversion of Santa Cruz into an annex of Silicon Valley without rent control or renter protection intensifies the emergency. UCSC students in past years have done sleepouts downtown protesting the sleeping ban. 20 to 30 were arrested in 1989 at the town clock. UCSC musicians have done benefits against the law. UCSC activists like the Rascals and Students Against the Sleeping Ban have organized forums and debates. The UCSC community provided hundreds of registered city voter signatures to put the sleeping ban on the ballot in two initiative drives that fell short in 1998 and again in 1999. Were students to take the lead in attacking the sleeping ban and related anti-homeless laws through strong, persistent protest, it is likely the laws would be changed. UCSC students can vote in the city elections. To do so, they must change their registration to their new local address. Vote for candidates who agree to immediate and clear abolition of the sleeping ban and blanket ban sections of the camping ordinance and rewriting of the entire camping ordinance, which currently bans rather than regulates camping, which is what should be the case. Don't be fooled when smoothies duck the issue by talking about building shelters, providing services, and supporting affordable housing. Those are all good things, but in the meantime, the city needs to end nightly human rights violations against the poor. Ask them if they will end the sleeping ban before Christmas. Delay, deny, dupe, duck, and divide is the usual scenario. At the moment, only candidate Simba Kenyatta has even said he will, what is it? Is it examine the sleeping ban or discuss the sleeping ban? I'm not quite sure exactly how he's putting it. He's trying to take a low profile on that issue, too. If UCSC students want to make a difference, come out and vote and show your support for candidates. Well, I guess for Kenyatta in the absence of another candidate. But also, and this was the issue that I brought up on campus today, simply vote no on Rotkin and Matthews, period. And the flyer that I and Tim Rumford and Thomas Levitt produced reads as follows. The gruesome twosome, vote no. No to recycled royalty. No on Rotkin and Matthews. I'll be reading more of that flyer, actually, after playing some interviews because... Well, my voice is wonderful to behold. Other voices might be nice to hear, too. If you want your voice heard on the stream and on this archive, you can give a call in, 427-3772. Or if I'm mistaken and we're actually broadcasting, please somebody call and give me the good news, again, at 427-3772. There is a chance there'll be a caller from out of the area, Stephen Percy, the Berkeley attorney, who put a... I guess you'd call it an effigy of a soldier on his house in Sacramento. He had a house in Sacramento. He was a Berkeley attorney, but he had a house in Sacramento. And it was being strangled, and the words on the effigy said, "Bush lied, I died." And, of course, he was severely criticized by some neighbors, and it was torn down several times. He has some new... I want him to give me an update on some new stuff that's come down around the war and around some other issues up there, and we'll see if he's calling in tonight or possibly Sunday when perhaps the technical wizards of Free Radio will actually have the whole thing back on the air again, not just on the stream. I think it has to do with some peculiar misunderstanding about an unpaid bill that Free Radio paid but that some other people didn't pay, but what do I know? Anyway... what we got is what we got here tonight, and feel free to call in. Again, 427-3772. For those of you who don't know, you can check this archive later at huffsantacruz.org, www.huffsantacruz, all one word, all small letters, .org. Now I'm going to try this tape, which may be a little fuzzy. I did it earlier today up on campus at the Volunteer Fair, which is where a couple interviews fell my way, and we'll see how they sound.
Well, it's about 12:45 on October 19th, 2006. I'm up here at the base of UCSC campus where a scraggly band of volunteer tablers waiting for the fourth load of tablers to be taken up to the fair, the volunteer fair that's happening on campus today. I'm talking with Bill White. And Bill, you... Well, what are you doing here at the fair today?
I'm president of a group called Creative Response to Conflict Incorporated. And we work mostly with schools in training students and their teachers and the staff how to resolve conflicts without resorting to violence.
You haven't talked to Fuhrer Bush lately, though.
No, I haven't. But I found out a little bit about what he's been up to.
Well, he's in the news a lot, and of course I'm wearing his photo on my chest in honor of his military commissions bill, which was signed on the 17th. All right, here's our shuttle. Well, maybe we can talk more about your experience at the Providence Airport.
I went back east this summer, and flying back home, I was due to take a plane out of Providence, Rhode Island, and my wife and I went up to the baggage check-in, and the guy went to his computer and said, oh, there's a problem.
We'll be returning to that interview in just a moment. Be with me.
Actually, we never did return to that interview. What Bill told me was that he got a significant grilling off to the side and was told that he now had a number and had to use his full name whenever he was traveling because there was somebody else who was on a no-fly list with a similar name to his or a name that he in part replicated. The T-shirt that I was wearing yesterday on campus did indeed have a photo of our Führer, President Bush. It had his picture and it had the description international terrorist on it, of course, trying to frame the issue as it should be framed, not as the L.A. Times, for example, framed the War Commissions Act, which passed on that dark day, October 17th, which we shall remember in the years to come, when the Constitution was formally set aside by the Congress. L.A. Times described the law. Well, I'll read a story from Counterpunch about that in a bit. But they described it as a way of facilitating the trials of war criminals before military commissions, or what do we call them, unlawful enemy combatants. Anyway, here's some more interviews from the day up on campus.
Here it's about 20 to 1. I'm talking to Aaron Dankman. And Aaron, I was given a flyer when I set up the Huff table here at the Volunteer of Fear. The Regents are coming to campus, and the 20 minutes they allow for public comment is a farce. You actually were there observing the entire day, much of the day at the Regents meeting yesterday?
Yeah.
And, of course, the headlines in the paper today talk about students being arrested and so forth. You want to give us an update of what went on?
Well, exactly what happened is a really long story, but in short, at one point, police opened the door to the Humanities Lecture Hall, and students were very close to that door, and two people from the inside were trying to get out, and the police were trying to escort them out, and there wasn't much room. So in response, they built a line, they pushed the line out, they being the police officers, built a line, they pushed the line out, they grabbed students who were not close to the door, one of which was the only black face in a crowd of mostly white students.
And you can't be too careful with these colored folks.
Oh. Don't get me caught in the middle of this crossfire, I beg you. But, you know, so they grabbed these students. None of the three students who were grabbed were as close as the closest students. None of them were as rowdy as the rowdiest students. You know, the administration and the police were complaining about people who were escalating the situation. But then when they had the opportunity to do something about the people who were escalating the situation most extremely, they chose instead to grab people who were, you know, not as importantly involved in the escalation. They pulled them inside, and then they sprayed mace. I don't know if they know how to aim those things, but I am under
pepper spray, same thing.
Oh, God. It burned like hell.
You were there, and you got sprayed?
Yeah, it burns on your hands, it burns on your body, and it burns really bad on your face and your eyes, and they sprayed it indiscriminately into the crowd.
Now, let's go back. When did this whole thing start?
The action itself?
Yeah.
It started at about 2:45 right here in the Baytree Quarry Plaza, and then there was a march up to the Humanities Lecture Hall. And
how many students involved?
I'd say about 200, and then
the issues
filtered in and out. Well, the main issue through which all the other issues flow is that the Regents of the University of California do not represent the interests of the students, do not represent the interests of the voters or the taxpayers. They're non-democratic. There is no way that you can put input into that system. They don't listen to you, and even if they did, you only have 20 minutes to say your piece at any given Regents meeting. At least half of the Regents are on major corporate boards of national and multinational corporations. We have Regents voting to pay themselves and their own companies money to subcontract work from the University of California.
Suggesting these Regents are corrupt?
I don't use the word corruption because I really don't find many people in public office who wouldn't qualify for that word. But
so you're saying you don't want to trivialize the whole situation?
Yeah, I mean, this is a structural problem. It's endemic, and it's part of the process of deinstitutionalizing any sort of input that people might have into supposedly public institutions.
So 200 students were concerned about what particular region policies recently illustrate this concern you have about the regions being unresponsive or undemocratic or in violation of the interests of the voters and the students?
It's really hard to pick and choose. issues, but two main issues would be constant increase in student fees without any corresponding increase in the quality of education or the resources available to us. So where's that money going? It's not going to my classrooms. It's not going to the TAs I don't have.
Son, there's a war on. It went yellow alert. Now aren't you going to do your bit?
Wasn't it orange?
Orange, yellow, it changes from day to day depending on the situation.
All I know is I'm really, really afraid. And, you know, so one of the things would be, where's our money going?
Mm-hmm.
All right, and it's not going to our resources. Another one of the things would be the nuclear weapons lab, justified as a public service to Homeland Defense, but really just a very thinly veiled for a profit-motivated plan to update nuclear weapons arsenal that only leads to escalation and more problems in the world. And they think this nuclear weapons arsenal that they're now building, they're contracting to build this in a limited liability corporation with private institutions, if they think that's going to make us safer, they need to start attending these universities and learning foreign policy before they start building weapons of mass destruction.
So here on campus, is there any such research going on that you know of?
That's a much more complicated issue. There are grants from the DOD in 2005-2006. There are 28 of them. There are all kinds of programs to build military-ready technologies that happen on this campus and every one of the UC campuses, and then also the weapons labs and the other labs that they manage.
Now, the groups that were supporting this protest, were there organized groups or simply spontaneous protests from individuals that did this march at 2:45?
It's a little bit of both. There were people who came together in an ad hoc coalition prior to the event to organize flyers and to try and work on some of those messaging issues to try and shape a specific kind of action. At the same time, many of the people there are also involved in other student organizations, which include organizations like the Student Worker Coalition for Justice and Students Against War, which are two of the most commonly cited ones, but also students from all kinds of organizations like Rainbow Theater and endless others. So there was an ad hoc coalition, but it did also in some ways represent a number of student groups on campus.
So had this been prepared for a while? I mean, I guess you knew the regents were coming, right?
Not very far in advance. They gave us 1.5-2 weeks' notice. So, I mean, the last time they came to this campus, this is the second time in 40 years. They're afraid of this campus. They should be afraid of this campus. It's not surprising that they didn't give us much notice, but they knew that there was going to be some sort of student action. They just had no idea what it would look like.
And indeed, Students Against War and other groups were successful in discouraging certain military recruiters last spring from continuing their recruiting, as well as, I guess, discouraging them this fall as well.
It's unclear to me whether or not the administration is lying to us about the upcoming job events, but one thing is clear, which is that if everybody who's giving us information is telling the truth, the military will not show up in the form of the Marines or the Army or the Air Force, but they might still show up in, I don't know, there's some medical subunits and things like that might still be at this upcoming job fair. But in a sense,
When is the job fair?
Oh, gosh, I don't know, Mr. Norris, but I do know that the administration's line in this case is that we are breaking down the job fairs into different types, and the military just doesn't belong at this type, and so they're just not coming to it, and it has nothing to do with students. And that's what they like everybody to believe, but the truth is that when students organize, come out in numbers, and take a stand, things can change. And the administration will never concede that, because it will just encourage us to take back our university with more fervor than we are right now.
So volunteer day today, are there any Marine recruiters here that you know of?
Not to my knowledge.
Well, I didn't tell you about my latest job. No. So anyway, getting back to yesterday, you had a rally here. You spoke, or many human people spoke. They talked about the concerns you mentioned, and then they marched.
And then they marched up to the Humanities International Study, the new building. I don't know what it's called, really. Humanities Outpost. And Humanities Outpost, there you go. Our new building that they encourage us not to hurt the facade of, because it's just coming out of our tuition, that they have to replace that facade, which they never hesitate to remind us what comes out of our tuition all the time.
Mm-hmm.
But they show some hesitation when they're asked what isn't coming from our tuition. At any rate, we went up there and we organized a student speak out, and that student speak out spread to in front of the doorway, at which point...
How many people were there?
About 200, filtering in and out at different times. But so we had the students speak out, and issues were addressed about outreach and retention, which is a really important issue because the university cuts that, and now it's all on students to raise the money themselves, to run the programs themselves, to get people from inner cities, to get people who aren't already prepared for college. And it's basically a struggle against the gentrification of the university, which is a policy that, you know, despite their lip service to diversity, is clearly being implemented.
Now, in terms of the university budget, is the university budget generally being cut, or is it simply being reallocated?
It's a little bit of both. For instance, there's what is called a general fund that is distributed to each campus. And of this general fund, each of the divisions, humanities, natural sciences, et cetera, gets a certain percentage. Now, last year, the humanities percentage of that general fund was 23%. This year, it is only 20%. 3%, not a big deal if you're leaving a tip. Really big deal if you're trying to run a humanities division. And where do you think that money went? Well, David Klieger will tell you where that money went, because David Klieger was behind the board run by Susan Gilman, who decided to allow that 23 to 20% reduction through. So what are they doing? They're taking money out of humanities and they're putting it in natural sciences. And sure, I believe natural sciences are important, and I do understand the value, the quality, and the expense of labs and of the very specific technical training that's required for a science student. I also think that if that comes at the cost of having teacher's assistants for upper division politics or humanities classes, then who are they kidding telling us they're running a diverse institution of education? That's, in short, bullshit.
So how would this interest the community of Santa Cruz, which goes, those wealthy students on the Hill, well, they have some problems with their curriculum, why should I give a shit?
Two reasons. The first is because the only people that they're going to be able to ally with in this fight against the irresponsible, destructive expansion of the university is students who are defecting from the university line. The second problem is that the reason that these students on this campus don't give a fuck most of the time is because the university has a very clearly implemented policy of gentrifying the student population more and more each year. So the students who come here come from richer and richer suburban high schools, they come with wider and wider faces, and the university looks to me now like a microcosm of, you know, a Regent's cocktail party. And if the townspeople, you know, legitimately have a problem with the kinds of arrogance and disrespect that come with these, you know, well brought up students, quote unquote, then, you know, they should be, you know, I would like to work with them on getting the university population to more directly reflect the population of the state at large.
Now, how long have you been on campus and active in this struggle?
3.5 years.
And has changed in the last 3.5 years?
Very much so. When I showed up here, it was a really quiet campus comparatively, in terms of actions at least. And the following year exploded with a strike that shut down the campus at both entrances for many, many hours, with the first successful counter-recruitment action of its kind at this university in the past 10 years, with all kinds of actions that were really liberatory and very exciting. At the same time, since then, we've seen the university update its tactics and responses to those kinds of actions, but we haven't seen the, you know, quote-unquote activists updating their tactics and responses in response to the university's response. And so there have been many changes in this constant battle, and there are always new ideas coming out of the student movements on this campus, and it's just a question of working together until we can find an organizational network that allows us to coalesce in the most effective form possible. And hopefully that is with the help of and the communication with and cooperation with the community members who don't attend this campus, because I think that that is very important on a personal level, and I think a lot of students here recognize how important this community is to us.
I'm going to ask you about outreach into the community in a moment. Of course, we've left behind the more dramatic moments of what happened yesterday, and we'll go back to that, too. But I guess the question I have here is with respect to that other question, which was, you say the campus has changed in terms of more conservative attitudes, whiter skin color. Have you seen that happening in the last 3.5 years?
Well,
it sounds like you've seen it getting more active in the last 3.5 years.
To a certain extent. Little by little, changes come. So it's really hard necessarily I mean, it can be very difficult to see those changes while you're in this place and you're seeing them happen little by little by little. So
you make these statements very positively as though you have some documentation. So as an honest reporter who may be sympathetic with you but wishes to get all the facts.
Look into outreach and retention programs. They get slashed more and more every year, guaranteed. That's not numbers on students who arrive at this campus. That's numbers on the amount of money, resources, and efforts that this university is willing to put towards getting students who wouldn't already otherwise be coming to college, right? And so that's something that you can look up. That's hard fact. And there are a lot of SIL groups here, student-initiated outreach groups here, that year after year after year deal with less and less funding. And if you look, for instance, at learning support services are the kind of services that go to students who want extra help and sometimes need extra help getting their university work together and learning how to learn. And yet, this year, learning support services has gone from a half budget to a non-existent budget. So they're going to cut learning support services, which is the only thing available on campus, and which isn't cheap sometimes for some students who have to pay to get into it by taking tests and so forth to prove that they have a valid reason to use the services. So if you look at that particular program, right, if that program gets cut, now they're going to send a student ballot matcher asking students each individually pay $10 a quarter to support this program that should be run by the university. That's the kind of thing that I'm talking about when I talk about gentrification, when I talk about elitism, because how are you supposed to come to a university that refuses to pay money to support you?
Right, you're talking about policies that are
right.
That would seem to produce that kind of result. We don't actually know what the actual result is yet, at least in terms of the figures, but nor from even your offhand impressions as to whether it's wider than it used to be.
It's not numerically
wider at the managerial level. Who knows? Maybe in the mentality, it may be wider. So, but again.
Can I clarify something, Robert, though?
Sure.
I'm not saying that the university has a general trend to increase the whiteness of its students numerically, necessarily.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I bet that's not true. I mean, looking at, say, you know, the 60s versus now.
I'm talking about the 90s versus now.
Yeah, and even the 90s versus now. That could very well not be true. I mean, it doesn't help that Ward Connerly spent, you know, the last of his glorious energies ending affirmative action at our fine public institution here. But in addition to problems like the end of affirmative action at the University of California, we have 30 years now waiting on a promise from this campus to give us an ethnic studies department. We have, like, all kinds of legitimate problems and complaints, and unfortunately there are so many of them that they just get dropped by the wayside year after year after year, and the bar gets lowered and lowered. And so though it might not be true that trend is actually numerically accurate, it is definitely true that this campus is getting richer and richer each year, and that really helps with the apathy that keeps the administration comfortable.
Richer and richer, by which you mean not that the amount of money being spent by the university on the students is richer and richer, or the amount available to the university is richer and richer.
The per capita income of the families
income
and
of the students.
Yeah.
Which might be the rationale the university uses for saying, well, if it's richer and richer, let the students pay for it. They're richer, you know, which we could talk about. But now let's get back to the issue of what happened outside the Regents meeting. Continue.
That they grabbed these three students and pulled them inside, the speak out ended for a little bit, and we began negotiating with the university administration.
When there were students inside who were trying to get outside, they were letting them out, and then
there were two people from the community who were inside. When they opened the door to let them out,
were there any students inside?
There were student reporters, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And exactly what point the student reporters went in or came out, I'm not positive.
Did they allow students into this meeting?
Not generally, that door was shut down, but there were somehow people getting inside at one point or another. So there were students let in at some point, but what happened is that they grabbed up these three students and pulled them inside, and then
Because there was some raucous demonstration or some... What was the reason that they claimed what they gave for gapping anybody in the first place?
That it's our fault for being unpeaceful, basically.
Were any windows broken?
No.
Were any people assaulted by the students?
Not to my knowledge.
Was the Regents meeting drowned out so the Regents couldn't conduct business?
The Regents don't pay attention to the public comment period anyway, so give me a fucking break, and no, it wasn't.
So what justification in any even neutral sense do you think the police would have given? They claimed that there was a
public safety. We're blocking exits. You have to have easements to buildings like that. Otherwise, you're breaking fire code and health and safety codes. And at that point, they're justified in taking whatever brutal action necessary to save the people on the inside. You know, you do the math if that makes sense. The university has this really funny history of telling students that they unleash the police with absolutely no checks or control on them, on the students, in the name of our own safety and the safety of community members. And personally, that doesn't add up for me. If you look at this action, if you look at Tent University, it doesn't make sense the university would unleash police on students, police who are brutal and have no respect for human life, in the name of our own safety.
Of course, you're referring to what happened about 6 months ago in April of 2006. This year.
No,
it was a year ago, wasn't it?
Yeah.
I forgot, so it was 2005.
You got to go. So, summing up very quickly, what's the status? Three students are in jail?
No, they were cited and released based on negotiations that happened with the administrators for about 6 hours after they were pulled inside. Now they have these citations, and there's no guarantee on the part of the administration that they won't press judicial academic charges against the students, and they're also not doing any work to urge the DA to drop the charges or expunge
the citation. They were released in order because of pressure by the rest of the students who were protesting, right?
Sure, but what were they going to do? Keep them in there, arrest them, and take them to prison for something they did do? I mean, it's clear to everybody who was standing there, the ticks in their eyes when they lie, that these people were not doing anything justifying them getting pulled inside, justifying the macing.
And that was an interview, which seems to be maybe failing because of battery problems. Hopefully that's just happening now and didn't happen then. You're tuned to freakradio.org, www.freakradio.org, and you may be listening to this in an archive show. I'm Robert Norris, and this is called Bathrob Spears Broadsides. Let's see if we've got the rest of this interview up at UCSC today, October 19th. It looks like we don't. Wait, maybe we do. Hang on here.
Reasonable observer that was there. So, you know, I don't think they had any way of defending the action to arrest these students. So the best they could hope for was a citation.
Did any students seek medical attention and other members of the community seek medical attention?
Indeed. When we were all pepper sprayed, we did ask for medical attention. Nobody there expected that. Nobody there expected that the cops would actually use that kind of violent weapon on protests that, whether or not you think it was peaceful, was not of an equivalent threat. That was undue force. There was no caution used, and it was just ridiculous that they would use that kind of violent weapon.
Are the students planning some kind of protest in the days to come to demand a change in this kind of policy which allows the police to do this?
That depends on the student body's response. The unfortunate thing is that a lot of these students do not have an interest in police brutality, do not have an interest in reclaiming the university, and that's got a lot to do with how public education functions and how apathy is really considered a virtue by the administrators that ran my high school and that run the university I'm now attending.
We've been talking with
Aaron Dankman. Thank you, Mr. Norris.
And Aaron, how can people get more information about this subject? Give a call to 423-HUFF. I will try to put you in touch with Mr. Dankman and his questionable cronies.
Thank you, Mr. Norris. That sounds good. I don't have contact information. This was an ad hoc collective. So, yeah.
All right. Well, thank you for taking the time here at the volunteer fair.
The volunteer fair. Well, thanks for taking an interest, Mr. Norris.
All right, man.
And as I look at the indiebay.org/Santa Cruz site, Indie Media locally, you can go there, too, if you want. It's probably still up, even if you're listening to an archived version of this show. There's a segment, Why We're Here and What We're Fighting For, on the UC Regents protest. And there are the demands, Why We're Here and What We're Fighting For, a letter to the UC Santa Cruz community. The Regents are illegitimate, undemocratic, and unaccountable. Many UC workers continue to receive undignified and unlivable wages. Our student fees continue to skyrocket as top administrators receive lavish bonuses. The numerous social, environmental, and educational repercussions of campus expansion, the need to diversify the students and faculty, as well as provide racial and ethnic studies options, the need to fully fund student-initiated outreach, retention, and academic prep programs, the need to create a safe haven for immigrant AB 540 students, the need to reprioritize academics, upping the quality of education, including supporting languages, writing, and journalism, ensuring teaching assistance for all classes that need them, and then against immoral UC weapons research, including nuclear bombs at Lawrence Livermore and Los Alamos. What we are asking for, democratization of the UC system and UCSC. Fix it first. Before we even discuss the possible expansion of the campus, we need to seriously address the core issues that face our community, some of which are listed above. This is not done. An expansion of the campus will also mean an expansion of the problems. If there are resources to consider expansion, then there are the resources to fix our university. Why protest the UC Regents' visit? The UC Regents are the people in the UC system that ultimately call the shots. They're undemocratic appointees who are concerned more with their personal interests than our education. When our tuition is raised, even when the UC system makes millions in profits, it's because of the Regents. When nuclear weapons are designed in UC-run labs, it's because of the Regents. And when affirmative action was banned in the UC system, it was because of the Regents, a ban that was only rescinded through years of struggle. When we protest, we're not only saying that we don't recognize the legitimacy of the UC Regents, but it is they, among others, who have caused the problems that we demand be fixed. But why mess with the public comment period? We know that many in our community have serious issues that need to be communicated with the Regents. But we also know the Regents have no real desire to address our concerns. It's been 5 years since they visited UCSC, and yet they just hold a couple short comment periods, giving us mere seconds to speak. Even this they do not because they're interested in what we have to say, but because they're required by law to hold public comment periods whenever they get together. Sounds a little familiar to us city council regulars. We've been to Regents' meetings, we've made our speeches, we've tried to make them listen, but all they do is laugh, turn their backs, take naps, and kick us out of their meetings. The public comment period is not our few minutes of opportunity, but a farce intended to hold up an undemocratic and unaccountable system. When we reject this comment period and hold our own community speak out, we are taking back our voices, taking back our university, and showing the world how we really feel. Next steps from here. This is just the beginning. We've been silent too long as our university has been systematically undermined. Unless we continue our fight, the university we applied to will not be the university we graduate from. We can't assume that those in power will make the right decisions. It's not in their interest. Instead, we have to trust ourselves. It's time we put the university back in responsible hands, our own. In solidarity, concerned members of the UCSC community, including folks from Ask Me 3299, that's American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, I believe, Asian Pacific Islander Student Alliance, Bay Area Anarchist Council, Coalition of University Employees, Q, Disorientation Guide, Labor Film Collective, Engaging Education, E2, Movimiento Estudiante Chicana y Chicano de Aztlán, that's Mecha, Movement for Immigrant Rights Alliance, MIRA, The Project, Rainbow Theater, Save Our Language, SOUL, Students Against War, SAW, Students Informing Now, SIN, Student and Worker Coalition for Justice, SWCJ, Third World and Native American Students Press Collective, TWANAS, and United Auto Workers Members for Quality Education and Democracy, UAW Quad. And then there's a series of comments on this same thread here on Indy Bay, the most controversial of which reads, students started the violence, by someone who calls herself I Was There Too, or himself. I'm beginning to think the owners of this website are posting only stories that support their version of what occurred, because my first-hand viewing of experience was very different than what is being portrayed here. Or maybe it's just two different perspectives of the same occurrence. Perhaps I'll find my answer to this question if my post gets displayed. Here's what I saw yesterday. This was posted today at 3:22 in the afternoon. As the bus pulled in, I saw students hitting the bus, pushing police. I specifically saw an African-American female with short-cropped hair strike an officer in the shoulder blades from his backside as she ran through their line. I believe she is the girl who later got arrested. I also observed her spitting on the bus, cursing the driver of the empty bus, and hitting the bus. As cops closed the session and blocked the doors to further entrance, two male students, both with bandanas covering their faces, both in dark hoodies, hurled objects at police who were manning the front door. I confronted one myself. He denied it. I told him I saw him do it. He ran down Hagar, dropping clothing and changing his appearance as he fled the scene. Just prior to the pepper spraying, I saw police attempting to escort one of the public comment speakers out of the hall. Students surrounded them, yelling it was a Regent, and they began pushing, and then bodies went down on both sides. I found it particularly telling in the picture shown in the Sentinel today that the exchange student shown is grabbing the policeman's leg while his friends trying to pull him away. The police aren't even touching the student. I observed how the student ended up on the ground firsthand. He threw himself bodily at the police and fell after ramming into them. I expect by today he'll say he was knocked down. Pictures will prove otherwise. To say that the police started the violence is a lie, in my opinion. To say that your group was peaceful is a lie, in my opinion. Many were, but some weren't. Protesters absolutely threw the first blows and pushed the first bodies around, not the police. You guys are in sad company. It seems that Ronald Reagan created the last big Regents protest at UC by trying to silence a speech by a Black Panther Party member. Yesterday, you guys tried to do the same. Shut it down was your message. I dislike your actions as much as I do Reagan's, and I don't appreciate either of you trying to decide for me who I can hear speak and who I can't. In attempting to silence free speech, you become as bad as those you're trying to silence. And that, again, is a posting among a number, probably the longest posting in response to the earlier statement about what the protest was about. It's called Students Started the Violence. Also in the Santa Cruz Sentinel, on the front page above the poll, the fold, UCSC student protest erupts. And there's a picture of a student having his eyes washed after UCSC student Ben Sellers, an exchange student from England, has water washed into his eyes, splashed into his eyes after getting pepper sprayed by campus police. And that's one of the photos. There's a picture of a guy who's having water splashed on his eyes. Then there's a picture of this UC police, again, as described by I Was There Too in this last critique of the students, on the ground with his shirt off, his friends pulling him. He's holding on to the leg, I guess it's of a police officer, because it's an individual with boots, and the police aren't apparently touching him, but his friends are. University police wrestle with UCSC student protesters, reads the Sentinel caption underneath. Over control of English exchange student Richie Jones on Wednesday as protesters blocked the exit of members of UC Board of Regents from their meeting on campus. And for more photos, maybe I'll go online and check it out. You can visit this website, santacruzphotogallery.com. Three arrested at Regents meeting is what the story says, Roger Seidman's story. It's probably available online at the Sentinel website. UC Santa Cruz students shut down a rare public hearing hosted by the University of California Board of Regents in a 90-minute campus standoff Wednesday afternoon that had Regents trapped indoors and demonstrators clashing with the police. The Regents, making an official campus visit for only the second time in 40 years, were forced to cancel the remainder of their campus tour when roughly 150 students protesting a host of issues from cuts in humanities programs to UC nuclear research blocked the doors to a campus lecture hall around 4:30 p.m. The activists demanded the release of three protesters who had been demanded inside by university police. In a scuffle at the hall's entrance, police pulled the three into the building and used pepper spray and batons to subdue the crowd outside. The three, two students and an alumna, were arrested. One will face three felony counts of battery against a police officer, according to campus spokeswoman Liz Irwin, while the others face misdemeanor charges of disrupting a public meeting. As I've been charged with that, actually. Though never even ever tried or convicted on that one. One officer was injured, though the extent of his injuries were unknown. About 15 officers were inside the lecture hall. And other officers in riot gear were called to help control the crowd outside and ensure a smooth exit for Regents. I'm standing in there for an hour thinking I wish that they had come inside during the public comment period, Regent Odessa Johnson said afterward. We didn't even know what the issues were. Students, that's strange, maybe they don't read Indy Bay, or maybe they hadn't read the flyers the students put out, or maybe she was sleeping through the last few years. I'm not quite sure what Regent Odessa Johnson, what the problem was. Students never faced off directly with university leaders. A spokesman for the protesters said their original intent was to bar Regents from entering the building. The public comment process, they said in a statement to the press, is a farce because Regents don't take student input seriously. The clusters of students blocking every exit to the new Humanities Social Sciences Lecture Hall, administrators in the building used cell phones to talk to officials who were negotiating with student leaders outside to clear the way for regions to leave. This isn't the best situation. People are essentially being held hostage inside, student leader Samantha Aranki told fellow students. After much back and forth, Aranki and UCSC professor Paul Ortiz, who arrived during the standoff, were allowed to check on the condition of those arrested. Ortiz attempted to put the crowd at ease. I'm going to be inside, and I guarantee you will be there until the students are released, whether it's 5 minutes or 5 years, Ortiz said into a megaphone. Under heavy security, the region swiftly boarded a shuttle bus at a rear exit shortly after Ortiz and Aranki arrived. So they didn't have any trouble leaving, apparently. And it doesn't tell us what the arrests were originally for, really, and what the crowd was doing other than they were trying to control the crowd. We do have the comments of the person online who claims the students provoked it by hitting the bus, pushing police, an African-American female striking an officer in the shoulder blades from the backside as she ran through their line, two male students hurling objects at the police and with bandanas covering their faces, and a guy in the picture in the Sentinel, according to this anonymous witness, be nice if she or he came forward. Let's see, what did you say? He said that he threw himself bodily at the police and fell after ramming into them. So, two different accounts, and this is the first I heard about it was by reading the Sentinel this morning, and then, of course, I read this when I came to the studio, this Indy Bay account. I've been up there all day, and I've got these interviews which give you some indication. And you're also going to be hearing a meeting of students and other community members concerned about the issues and the three students who are being charged with various felonies. We're going to get into that now. And if you have any questions or comments, if you're listening on the stream or if you're listening through outside the door of the studio or if you're telepathic, give a call. 427-3772 is the phone number here. I should be back on Sunday with more coverage of the upcoming shitty council meeting coming up on Tuesday. And I will also, hopefully we'll have an even better flyer out. We had a flyer trying to characterize the Rotkin-Matthews history. Matthews, of course, is the mayor of Santa Cruz, and she and Mike Rotkin, a prior mayor and also a city council member, are running for re-election and have spent the most money. They're the most conservative. Well, perhaps some others are the most conservative, but they are the most hidebound and the most entrenched and certainly the most recycled members of the city council. And I was urging people today and urge you to defeat these two, whatever you do. Huff, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, has endorsed Simba Kenyatta with the proviso that he commit himself to real action after the election in support of any homeless tent city that may arise this winter protesting Santa Cruz's unconstitutional and abusive human rights trampling law, the sleeping ban, and its sister laws, the camping ban and the blanket ban. Haven't heard back quite clearly from Simba yet on that issue, though I think his answer was sort of in the affirmative. Let's hear some more from UCSC after a little musical break.
Is there anybody here who'd like to change his clothes into a uniform? Is there anybody here who thinks they're only serving on a raging storm? Is there anybody here with glory in their eyes, loyal to the end, whose duty is to die? I want to see him. I want to wish him luck. I want to shake his hand. Want to call his name. Put a medal on the man. Is there anybody here who'd like to wrap the flag around an early grave? Is there anybody here who thinks they're standing tall around a battle wave? Is there anybody here who'd like to do his part? Soldier to the world and a hero to his heart. I want to see him. I want to wish him luck. I want to shake his hand. Want to call his name. Put a medal on the man. Is there anybody here proud of the parade who'd like to give a cheer and show they're not afraid? I'd like to ask him what he's trying to defend. I'd like to ask him what he thinks he's gonna win. Is there anybody here who thinks that following the orders takes away the blame? Is there anybody here who wouldn't mind a murder by another name? Is there anybody here whose pride is on the line with the honor of the brave and the courage of the blind? I want to see him. I want to wish him luck. I want to shake his hand. Want to call his name. Put a medal on the man. Is there anybody here so proud of the parade who'd like to give a cheer and show they're not afraid? I'd like to ask him what he's trying to defend. I'd like to ask him what he thinks he's gonna win. Is there anybody here who thinks that following the orders takes away the blame? Is there anybody here who wouldn't mind a murder by another name? Is there anybody here whose pride is on the line with the honor of the brave and the courage of the blind? I want to see him. I want to wish him luck. I want to shake his hand. Gonna call his name. Put a medal on the man. Put a medal on the man.
And that, of course, was Phil Oakes. Is there anybody here? And I'm going to try to get a hold of Roger Mensch, because I have some good news about the Mensch case, which I may repeat on Sunday because probably nobody can hear this. We're not really broadcasting today very well. But he has posted on the Internet today that his medical marijuana conviction in his first case was overturned. The Sixth District Court of Appeals reversed the conviction of medical marijuana caregiver and patient Roger Mensch because he was denied a caregiver defense and the jury given wrong instructions. This is a very long decision, which I haven't read, so I don't think it's appropriate to read it to you. I'm going to investigate it further. What I am going to try to do, though, and before I read it to you, and I will get back to you, we have a caller. Amazing. Hi there, caller. You're on free radio. Caller? Hello? Oh, I guess not. Try again, caller. If you want to talk to me while I'm doing a tape, I will catch you if you don't want to be on the air. And we'll try and put you on the air if you do want to be on the air. So, Roger Mensch's first trial is just his conviction has been overturned. And that means that he's no longer on probation, pending the, as I understand it. But he still he's been held for, he's been facing an August 2005 arrest for doing exactly the same thing he did before. Let's see what we got here. Let me see if I got the right line. Hang on here. Hi there. I hope you're on free radio. Can you hear me?
Hi, Robert. This is Mike Rhodes in Fresno.
Hey there, Mike. Talk up a little bit. We have a difficult connection here.
Oh, okay. Should I try calling back later?
No, that's good. You're good.
Oh, okay.
I now can hear you. Mike, I was just talking about a looks like a victory for medical marijuana people here in Santa Cruz, which is also a victory for homeless people, because they're on the first line of defense in that whole thing. But I know that you've also been, you have a lawsuit that we've seen a brief reference to in the local media, and you've been sending me some emails on. Plus, I read a story today about police brutality in Fresno. What's going on there?
Well, we got a lot going on here. The good news is that we had a significant victory today in federal court. The judge issued a temporary restraining order against the Fresno Police Department and the city of Fresno from ongoing and continuing attacks against the homeless. It was a real victory, and people are very excited about that because up until now they've been able to, pretty much do whatever they want. They think they are the law. and what the significance of the ruling is that it will stop the police and the sanitation workers from coming in with these big bulldozers and scooping up people's homes and throwing them in the back of garbage trucks. The law that we won on was that the city does not have the right to seize and destroy people's property. Apparently, there's something about that in the U.S. Constitution, the 4th and 14th Amendments.
Wait a minute. We know the homeless are these illegal enemy combatants, and as far as I'm concerned, where is Guantanamo? Don't they have room there?
Well, that must be what the people running the city of Fresno think, too, because they had a very able attorney arguing that if the city was prohibited from going in and cleaning up these areas, if they had to, in fact, store the property of these homeless people, they would not be able to maintain order in the streets. And the judge basically said, so what I hear you saying is that because the city wants to clean the streets, that's more important than the Constitution of the United States.
Hold it. What Constitution? I thought we lost the Constitution on October 17th when habeas corpus was repealed.
Well, you know, it was one of those rare victories. We don't have a lot of experience with this, Robert, but this was something that really made us excited here because they are recognizing that the Fresno Police Department and the city has to, if they're going to clean up an area, they say they get complaints from the residents, right, that they're going to go in and clean up. They can't just immediately seize and throw away people's property, that they have to go through something called due process and store it and give people an adequate opportunity to recover their possessions. They have to maintain them for at least 90 days. And the city attorney, you know, just said that that was burdensome and that he made a very eloquent argument for why the city shouldn't have to recognize the Constitution because it would force them to go to more trouble than they wanted to go to.
Yeah, it's burdensome. I mean, you know, and also it might compromise their intelligence. No, I'm thinking of the federal. Sorry. Yeah. So how many people attended this hearing, and what judge made the ruling?
Judge Oliver Wagner in the federal courthouse in Fresno. It's the Eastern California Division of the California federal court system. And there was a pretty large number of people, maybe a dozen homeless people attended. I suspect this is the first time they've been in that courtroom. And there were lots of reporters. This was on the front page of the Fresno Bee yesterday. Well, actually, what happened was that 2 days ago, the ACLU and other civil rights attorneys filed a lawsuit against the city of Fresno to basically stop them from these attacks and taking people's property. But in addition to that, to compensate the homeless people who have had their possessions taken away, I think that they're asking for $4,000 per incident of these attacks. And some of these people have lost their possessions 20 or more times over the last 2 years. So this was the first step of getting a temporary restraining order against the city of Fresno and the police department, which is all part of a very large and substantial lawsuit that the ACLU, it's a class action lawsuit, which will encompass all of the homeless people who've had their possessions stolen by the city and destroyed.
Let me ask you about this. This is great news, of course. I mean, I know that Oregon for years has had some some law requiring not just that they hold the possessions for a period of time, but that they give a certain notice before they come and remove campsites and take possessions, particularly since I'm sure it's probably true in Fresno, as it's true in Oregon, as it's true in Los Angeles, as it's true in Santa Cruz. There is no shelter for the overwhelming majority of people, and in essence, you're violating the ICORN guidelines, and you're violating the cruel and unusual punishment aspect of this, as decided by the Court of Appeals and the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals in the Jones case in Los Angeles.
They used the Jones case in today's courtroom. They argue that, and God, there's another one back in Miami that they argue.
Pottinger,
yeah.
Yeah.
And I mean, it just makes sense that the police can't come out and determine that all. What they're saying, of course, is that they're not throwing away anybody's possessions. What they're throwing away is trash. The judge said, to his credit, he says, you know, one person's trash is another person's
treasure. Yeah.
And that I will not put you, meaning the city or the police, in the position of determining, you know, what this means to somebody. And so if you're going to go out, and so the judge didn't prevent them entirely from these cleanups, but he said, if you're going to go out and clean up these areas, you've got to catalog and store the possessions, the property of the people, and give them an opportunity to recover. You have to give them good notice that you're going to come and do the cleanup, and then if there's things there, you have to save them and notify the owners of where they are and how they can be reclaimed.
Now, so there hasn't been then any acknowledgement that the people have a right to be in certain places. I mean, if someone wants to clean up the area, they did the same thing with homeless protests here in Santa Cruz in 1991. They would come to the town clock where there was a 24-hour protest against the first Iraqi war and against police violence in Santa Cruz and the sleeping ban, and they would, you know, hose things down and wash things off. And homeless people there would be willing to pick up their stuff and move it and then put it back down again. What's been the situation when the police have come? Have the homeless people been willing to move their stuff if there's a real cleaning operation, or have the police actually just not said they're cleaning, just get the hell out of here, or just not even said anything but taking people's stuff? What's the situation been up to now?
The city claims that they give people notice that they're coming, but I say that they don't. There have been a couple of instances where they have given notice.
But generally?
Generally, no.
And you say this because you have been, shall we say, getting first-hand reports, or you were there? Or?
Yeah. I've been at a large number of the raids that the city has conducted, and I've seen two, maybe three notices that they've given. Sometimes a day ahead of time, and sometimes a couple of days ahead of time.
How many raids have you been at?
It's in English only. It's given to the people who were there at the time, so it doesn't get to everybody. And they have come. They've said that they've noticed. They've notified people that they're going to come at 9 o'clock, and that they have to have their possessions removed by that time. But they'll then come at 8:30, and they'll bring the bulldozers in and clear things out. And so you have people there that may have been intending to take their possessions away, but didn't because they came earlier than expected.
How many of these bulldozing or cleaning operations do you either have personal or reliable information about? If you were to estimate,
I've witnessed six or seven myself. And Cynthia, one of my friends that lives there, says she's been in areas that have been cleaned out more than 20 times. So it's something that's gone on periodically over the years. They oftentimes don't give notice. They, public information officer for the Fresno Police Department, he made that same claim. And so I said, okay, give me a copy of the notice from the cleanup on, it was May something of this year, and he said, okay. He never got it to me. I got back to him in about 2 weeks, and I said, hey, Jeff, where's the letter that you said you're going to get me? And he goes, oh, well, I don't think I have it. Yep. He goes, but in the future, we'll be notifying them. And so I think a couple times after that, then they sent out some notices. But they have not notified people that they're coming consistently. And then you have situations where they come early. You also have situations where they'll tell some people and not others. So the notification has been scanty at best and non-existent at worst.
Well, in Los Angeles and now perhaps in San Diego, there is, well, there was a successful ACLU lawsuit to enjoin the police from clearing Skid Row downtown L.A., and I guess there's a similar lawsuit and that may be underway or that at least the city is afraid of in San Diego, challenging their sleeping ban because they have inadequate shelter, as all cities do. What's the situation in Fresno? Is there a sleeping ban? Is there a law that criminalizes camping or sleeping outside? Are people being arrested under it?
Well, effectively, they have a sleeping ban. I mean, what they're saying is that these people are on private property. Well, in fact, they're on public property. They're sleeping largely on Caltrans land. And they also sleep in public parks. You know, people sleep where they can. The situation is that there's totally inadequate housing for homeless people in this community. There are thousands of people in the downtown area that need someplace to sleep, and there's generously saying there's maybe 200 beds in shelters. And those are questionable at best. The one place is the Rescue Mission. They've got about 140 or 150 beds for men only. And you have to endure a two-hour lecture on Christianity before you can spend the night there. Then people are telling me that after the sermon, they're herded into a room where they're stripped of their clothes. They have to take a shower, get in pajamas. Their clothing and all their possessions are put in a room. And when they come back out the next day, they're only able to stay there. They go to bed like at 10. They have to get up at 5:30, and they're kicked out. When they go to get their clothing, if they had any money or any jewelry in their clothing, it's gone. Most people say the Rescue Mission is a racket, and that Larry Arce, who's the director, who, by the way, drives a late-model luxury automobile and works hand-in-glove with the police to harass them, also runs an outdoor drunk tank on the facility, is no friend of the homeless. In fact, the Rescue Mission, Larry Arce, directed his staff to go into a homeless encampment about a month ago and destroy it, take all of the tents, sleeping bags, mattresses, and destroy them, put them in a dumpster. And this was spotted by Lisa Apper, who's a community activist here. She works with the Catholic Worker. She was with some of the folks who had lost their possessions. They were looking around trying to find out where they were. They saw them in the dumpster at the Rescue Mission. They went in to reclaim their property. And Larry Arce called the police on the homeless people who were recovering their sleeping bags and tents. Police come out, tell them that they can't be there. Lisa says that this man stole our property and threw it in a dumpster, and the police would do nothing about it. He thought he was there to protect Larry Arce's property.
How do you spell Larry Arce?
Arce, I believe it's A-R-C-E.
And what date did this incident happen?
You know, Robert, I'm not at a place where I can find that. It was over the summer, probably in August.
Now,
go back in indie media. on the Central Valley site. You can work your way back, and you'll see the incident.
You could probably also find your description a year or two ago of these so-called open-air drunk tanks, which are actually kind of like concentration camps with...
Yeah, razor wire over the top.
Is that, that actually is now in place?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's operational. They're very proud of it.
And what exactly does this, what is this camp involve?
Well, what they do is they, it's men only, so there's a gender bias here. So it's, they only take men to, what, they've moved it from the original location where they were planning on having it, and, it was going to be under, an overpass. They've moved it out into, an open field, and it's like a circus tent. And so the police, the Fresno police, will find somebody that's homeless that has been drinking, and they will take them to the outdoor drunk tank. And it the rationale for this is that it will save the city money on booking fees at the county jail. So they, it costs them X number of dollars, something like $300.
So how do they know that, how do they know the person is homeless? Do they have an H kind of carved in the person's shoulder? Are they, I mean, so in other words, if I'm a fairly wealthy drunk and I stagger around downtown, they'll just sort of, if necessary, lock me up in jail. But if I'm a poor drunk, they'll take me to this barbed wire encampment? I mean, this razor wire encampment?
Yeah, well, you know, that's a good point. I mean, they don't have a... drunk tank up in North Fresno for the businessmen who get drunk. And, you know, I've always thought that they should have a outdoor drunk tank at River Park in the parking lot there, which is like, say you have a chain link fence around it with razor wire over the top. And perhaps you can have Muslims running it. And when these people come in that are drunk, these businessmen, they drop them off there. And the Muslims can attempt to convert them to their faith, which is what they do down here at the rescue mission. Larry Arce told me that he considers it his duty to convert people to the Christian faith because that's the only way that they're going to get better.
We're talking with Michael Rhodes. By the way, Mike, this is not going out live. It's streaming live, but it's not going out broadcast because we're having transmitter problems. But it is being archived. And it is going out in a stream to all the millions of eager computer listeners.
Well, they're all over the world. People can listen to this everywhere, right?
Definitely, all the time. The groups that are that have pressed this lawsuit include the ACLU and who else?
It's like the civil attorneys for civil liberties, something like that. I should get the exact name of that because. They're doing great work. And there's also a law firm in San Francisco that their attorneys are working pro bono on this. So there's three different legal entities that are engaged in the lawsuit and have been down here with a lot of frequency on the case.
Is this a new phenomenon? I mean, we've been trying to get people involved in lawsuits in Santa Cruz for decades, and we don't seem to be getting very far. How did you happen to get these folks involved? I mean, apparently they weren't interested in this obvious constitutional. Well, assuming we still have a constitution, let's grant that we do for the purposes of argument.
Yeah.
Even though, you know, as far as I'm concerned, on October 17th, if you and I can be declared unlawful enemy combatants at the whim of the president, which is now the case, and then denied everything but the writ of habeas corpus, and if we're aliens, denied that as well. Then we're really screwed, and the Constitution is a joke, and has been a joke for the last 5 years for a wide variety of 14,000 people being held overseas, as we speak, still being held.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, you know, and I say that because it pisses me off, and I also see it having implications for all of us here and now. But,
oh, yeah.
But you know, you got these attorneys to get to work on this issue. They didn't seem to be terribly interested in the drunk tank razor wire approach. They didn't give a damn that people were being subjected to forcible abuse by religious authorities in collusion with the state, in this case the city. Seems a violation of the First Amendment,
mm-hmm.
in more ways than one, as well as the Eighth Amendment, if you will, the cruel and unusual punishment. So suddenly they are interested. What changed their minds?
Well, let me first tell you the name of this group is the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights.
Gotcha.
It's the Northern California ACLU, and Heller Ehrman. Heller Ehrman. They're a large law practice up in San Francisco. I understand they have like 300 partners in this law firm.
Uh-huh.
And so they're providing pro bono services on this. Well, here's what I know, Robert, is largely because I talked with you one time from down at the homeless encampment. I was passing my cell phone around, and you were interviewing some of the homeless people there. After that conversation, you and I were talking about these horrendous conditions here, and you said something like, well, why don't you get a temporary restraining order or a preliminary injunction against them from these attacks? And it hadn't occurred to me. You know, I mean, I'm writing about this stuff, and I'm telling this story about what's going on, and with the hope that somebody's going to see it and do something about it. But, you know, just writing about it and telling the story, while I think there's some value to that, it's really something really needs to be done about it.
Mm-hmm.
So you made a suggestion that we look in the direction of taking legal action. And when I heard you say that, it just was like, yeah, that is what we need to do. So what I did is then I started sending around these stories to a number of attorneys that I know and saying, you know, well, look at this. I mean, they're violating these people's civil rights. You know, is there anything we can do? What about a temporary restraining order? You know, blah, blah, blah. So finally, some folks started coming together around this. And, you know, as the incidences continued, the pace of the incidences increased, folks came together and said, let's talk about this. And so there was a number of attorneys, actually a rather larger circle of attorneys, that started discussing the possibility of legal action. And they brought me in on the conversation to ask me the details of what had been going on. And we just proceeded down this road of they were interested. They said, well, okay, well, most of them were out from out of town, the Bay Area. And they said, we would like to come down there and visit. We'd like to see for ourselves what this looks like. And we just spent a lot of time talking with them, introducing them to the people we know that are homeless. And they've taken it from there. I mean, they've invested a lot of time and effort into moving this forward. And it's my impression that they realize there's a lot more that needs to be done. For example, as I was talking to people a couple of days ago, they were telling me that they get food stamps, right? They've filled out these forms for food stamps, and there's a box on there that says, "Would you like to register to vote?" And they mark the box, and the person there says, "Well, you're homeless. You can't register to vote because you don't have a home."
Oh, that's bullshit.
So all these people out there, there's thousands of people in downtown Fresno that are in this situation, and they've been entirely disenfranchised,
yeah,
and they're convinced that they can't vote.
You need an emergency restraining order prior to the election or delaying the election locally that allows them to vote. And particularly we're talking about congressional representatives. I mean, is there a close congressional race? I would assume not in Fresno, but...
Well, actually, there is. In that district where most people live, in the downtown area, there was an election this June for city council members. That election was determined by 1,000 votes. The homeless people don't really like the representative that's there right now, and there was somebody that they would really like to have voted for, but they were told by government officials that they were ineligible to vote.
It's a federal crime to interfere with the right to vote. I mean, it sounds like not only do you have a basis for a civil restraining order, I'm not a lawyer, but that's my layman's understanding, but you have a basis for bringing in some prosecutor to start filing criminal charges against these clowns. Of course, where are you going to find a DA or a federal attorney to prosecute, and particularly under the Bush regime or under the Schwarzenegger regime? I don't know. But, it certainly bears public exposure. This issue was fought in Santa Barbara in 1985. It was won. It was fought in Santa Cruz in 1978. It was won. So I don't know why this is the 21st century. I guess Fresno is taking its time. My sympathies.
We are, it's like a third world nation out here. And the powers that be get away with this stuff because nobody calls them on it. So anyway, my point was that, I've been talking to the ACLU about this. They're outraged at the violation of people's voting rights, and, they want to pursue this. The problem with the current election is it's coming up really quickly, and, they don't know if they can move that fast. I mean, they have they have resources, but they don't have enormous
right.
amounts of resources.
I mean, I don't have a lot of confidence in, the electoral process, not just because it's often fraudulent, but because you don't get any choices anyway in any meaningful sense, particularly for homeless people. Usually. I mean, there's exceptions, but usually that's the case. But one issue I am concerned about, and that, of course, is really relevant in Los Angeles and San Diego now, and also in Santa Cruz, is the right to sleep. Now, what's happening with that? If somebody, doesn't have much in the way of possessions, they're just trying to sleep, is it illegal for them to sleep in Fresno de facto? What's the deal for the average? Is there a specific law? Are they just police creatively cracking heads or rousting people or warning people?
Yeah, their policy is basically to just move people on, and then what they've been doing is they've been putting fences, chain link fences everywhere in the downtown area where the homeless live to prevent them from being in one area and then another. And it just like migrates from one area to another. Wherever the homeless goes, that's where the fences go up.
How about people in cars? What's the deal if you sleep in your vehicle? Is that legal? Are people being arrested for that?
No. There are some people that sleep in their cars there, but not very many, and I haven't heard any complaints about it.
Huh, interesting.
It's more that they will periodically come and take your possessions and move you out. But people don't seem one problem is that we have our jail is completely full right now. And there just is no place for them to put anybody, even if that's what their intention was.
Well, they need some more razor wire open-air palaces. We're talking with Mike Rhodes. You're tuned to freakradio.org, and you might be tuned to 101.1 FM if we had some miracle breakthrough. I'm Robert Norse, and Mike is in Fresno. You can check out his writings on indiebay.org/Central Valley. A great victory in a lawsuit today, which a federal judges ruled that they, what, are you actually going to get paid for this stuff? I guess that's yet to come, to be determined.
We got a temporary restraining order against the city of Fresno from destroying people's property.
They can come and confiscate your property, but they can't destroy it. So they can run into your house, take all your stuff, but they have to catalog it before they move you along. How nice! I mean, I suppose that. Forgive me for being sarcastic. It is a first step. It is good. The question is, what basis are they even approaching the homeless? As you probably know, in Miami, the Pottinger guidelines, which the ACLU secured in 1998. Prohibit a homeless person from having to answer, even to talk to a police officer about a so-called quality of life crime, namely sleeping, camping, lighting a fire, taking a crap, unless that officer has a shelter bed to offer that homeless person.
Well, what they do here a lot is simply line people up and interrogate them, search them. There's endless tales about how people are stopped on the street, they are searched, their names and information is sent into the database. And this is for people who are just walking down the street. I'm doing nothing more than walking to the store. They'll be stopped if they're in that area of town. Last Wednesday, something happened that I thought was a little more than usual. They came out to one of the largest encampments in the downtown area, lined all the men up against one side and all the women on the other side, made them stand there for some length of time to where people were very uncomfortable. They needed to leave, and they wouldn't let them leave. They searched them, patted them down, and then they put them all together, and the officer in charge said that they had to get out immediately, that the police were going to come back, and when they came back, they're going to destroy all their tents, their sleeping bags, everything that's here is going to be destroyed.
Now, so they're using this destruction of property as a club over to beat the homeless with. Do they use physical violence much as well or not?
I have heard stories that they have. I haven't witnessed it myself, but then, you know, they probably wouldn't do it while I'm standing there with my camera.
Right. Have you heard stories you believe are credible, or?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
How regular is it? Is it occasional? Is it regular? Is it frequent?
Well, here's an example. This guy is a diabetic, and he had a tent, and the city was conducting one of their cleanups. And this officer Ray Wallace, who's often out there, he's in that Southwest division. He came up and told him to leave. The guy continued to try to remove his tent, and Wallace, this guy tells me, he hits his hands away from trying to untie his tent from the fence, and then pushes him out so that they could bring the bulldozer in and scoop up his tent, which unfortunately also had his diabetes medicine in it. So, you know, that's an example of violence, of being hit to prevent you from removing your property.
Right, but it doesn't sound like, I mean, what I'm saying is once the tool of seizing property becomes more of a burden to the police than a thrilling punishment and a threat, I'm wondering what the next thing they're going to turn to abusively treat homeless people with and to intimidate and frighten them, because that's, of course, what they're doing. Right.
Right. Well, one clue might be that once they move them out of sort of a more visible area in downtown area by Ventura and E Street, they push them out, maybe two blocks from any place where there's any traffic, and it's under this bridge. And so then the police were all over them. They're there all the time, you know, parked, here. They're watching them. But then the police will leave, and several times now people have come in, and right as the police have left, they've come, and then they throw rocks, bottles, they've shot homeless people with paint guns.
These vigilantes, in other words.
They're vigilantes.
Sort of clan-type hate groups.
There was an incident where there's two cars. One car pulls up, people get out with baseball bats and come out and start hitting people. In the car behind it, there's a film crew, people filming this.
Oh, is this the latest version of bum fights or what?
Well, that's my guess.
You know, bum fights directors in July were convicted. They were put in jail. So it's interesting that
Well, they have a new series out, I guess.
I guess so. Maybe somebody's taken over. Mike, I appreciate your calling in. If you can try calling in again on Sunday, you might actually get some of this out to a live radio audience instead of the faithful computer gang.
Okay.
We'll be talking with Mike Rhodes of Fresno on the victory of civil rights activists in Fresno, and I hope that there's some among homeless who are also becoming civil rights advocates. Are you getting any leaders standing up and, you know, speaking out, or are people, you know, is this mainly a middle-class bourgeois suits and ties, journalists like yourself movement?
Oh, yeah. That's it. There's a number of people that are coming together. In fact, I'd like to invite your audience from all over the world to join us this weekend in Fresno. On Saturday, there's going to be a sleep-in at City Hall. We're going to have a rally there. We're going to talk about what's going on. We're going to share stories. We're going to organize, and we're going to spend the night there.
Maybe you'll set up a continuing tent city like Dignity Village in Portland, huh?
There's some talk about that. So this is the start of it, and so I'd like to invite you to come over and all your listeners to come to Fresno on Saturday at 4 o'clock at City Hall and camp out with us, and let's see if we can make more progress in stopping the city from attacking the homeless. I mean, the first step is stopping them from attacking folks, and then the next step is in making things better, getting them to provide some services, toilets, running water, trash bins. That's what we hope to accomplish, is ultimately to have a safe place for people to go that has community services.
Well, it's
what a concept, huh?
It's amazing. You know, you're talking about actually providing bathrooms, and that's only going to encourage more homeless people to come to Fresno and
it'll
cause
be
more
a mecca.
And cause, yeah, it'll become a magnet. So I'm afraid that's not a possibility. But you know, we can tell you that the police are doing what they can, and that your city is doing is, you know, it sounds like a great idea. I'm going to consider that invitation, and if I don't come, I want a full report. But who knows? I might show up there with my bathrobe and teddy bear. You never can tell.
I'd love to see you here. You'd have a great time. We'd take good care of you, Robert.
Well, thank you. And thank you for all this really detailed, painstaking, persistent work that has, first of all, educated other people in other communities as well as the Fresno community, and finally gotten these damn lawyers off their asses to do something. I mean, you know, I'm glad they started. I just wonder if they didn't start a decade ago. And I guess,
I don't know. But, yeah, I mean, they're really into it. And there's a herd of
good.
Them. I mean, we've had...
Well, we need to send one to Santa Cruz, please.
Okay. I'll talk to them about it.
Hey, thank you, Mike. And again, to check out Mike Rose, you got a phone contact for you if people want to reach you?
Sure. Call me on my cell phone. It's area code 559-978-4502.
559-978, and the last four digits?
4502.
4502. Thanks, Mike.
Thanks, Robert.
Call again on
Sunday.
See
you on Saturday.
Could be.
Okay. Bye-bye. Bye now.
And phone lines are open. If you're actually, we're open all the time because he called in on the second line. I should have mentioned that. You could have called and spoken to Mike, but you can also call him at his number, 559-978-4502. And I believe there's also an email and a website address for him, which I'll look for as I'm talking. Yeah, here we go. Central Valley News. Let's see how we going with this. If you go on the central, if you go on indiebay.org/Central Valley, you can find. You'll have to dig through a few of his articles, but I believe you can find Mike Rhodes' website, and you can certainly leave comments on the website. And it's an interesting story and a positive one, which I hope we can duplicate here in Santa Cruz. He just posted a new story of victory for the homeless in Fresno. It looks like an audio report on indiebay.org/Central Valley. Well, we got about 20 minutes left here in this show. I'm going to try one more time to reach Roger Minch and see if he is around. Roger is the man who is still facing, maybe his charges have been dropped, but he was facing a trial for felony possession and cultivation of marijuana. Let's see if we can get a hold of him. I'm ringing him here. Maybe we can catch him on the line and get the latest update. He does a thing called the Hemporium up in Felton. But it sounds like we're catching his machine. Hey, Roger Manch. This is Robert Norris calling in from Free Radio, the studio, no less. We just noticed your article online announcing your victory in the 6th Appellate Division of the District Court of Appeals, or I should say the 6th District Court of Appeals, reversing your conviction. Congratulations. And we're wondering what's happening with the latest shenanigans of the DA's office, DA Bob Lee, and the MET team, the Marijuana Enforcement Team. Locally, if you can give a call to the Huff line at 423-HUFF, you can give us a kind of a brief summary, or on Sunday, maybe you can call back to the show anytime between 9:30 and 1 in the afternoon, 427-3772, and keep us advised, because it's really important. You're not just, it seems to me, fighting for yourself alone, but you're fighting for others. Thanks, Roger. Again, 427-3772 on Sunday morning, or 423-HUFF anytime. Bye-bye. So I weren't able to get a hold of him. He's an elusive man, hard to get a hold of. And if you're listening to this show, feel free to call in. Because I think what I'm going to do, I have a lot more tape on the Regents, the protest against the Regents. But I don't know if I'm going to have time to play it. I did get another email from Carol Sobel, president of the Los Angeles National Lawyers Guild in Venice, it's about Venice Beach. A federal lawsuit has been filed for a Venice Beach free speech zone. This is not directly about the homeless, but it's about street performers and street folks and folks who are artists, activists, vendors. On October 16th, 2006, attorney Carol Sobel filed a new federal lawsuit on behalf of Venice Beach Boardwalk Free Speech Zone activists, artists, performers, and vendors. The lawsuit alleges that the city's second try at amending L.A. Municipal Code 42.15 in 2 years, an ordinance designed to restrict activity on the Venice Boardwalk, kind of like our downtown ordinances, you know, violates both the First and 14th Amendments. Under this latest version of LAMC 42.15, Susan B. Anthony would not be able to set up a card table, petition signatures, accept donations, and campaign for a woman's right to vote on Venice Beach without a permit and an assigned space until afternoon, even if there were plenty of empty spaces on the boardwalk. American flag lapel pins would be banned, and no one could sell a copy of the Bible because she did not write it herself. The lawsuit also challenges recent noise restrictions that are enforced against some performers and ignored by the police for everyone else. Venice has a long and unique history of celebrating freedom of speech and diversity. This ordinance unduly restricts constitutionally protected expressive speech and threatens to change the historic character of Venice Beach forever. And that's a good news. There's no decision yet, but that is a good news. And here's a bit of bad news. U.S. building a military airfield in Iraq, October 18th. Following hints U.S. troops may remain in Iraq for years, the United States is reportedly building a massive military base in Arbil, in Kurdish northern Iraq. Zaman, quoting a news article published on the first on the Firat news agency website, which is known to have close connections to the Kurdish Workers' Party, or PKK, reported on October 15th that the base, along with a smaller facility, is part of the Pentagon's larger strategic involvement in the Middle East. According to the Firat report, U.S. officials, in agreement with the regional Kurdish administration in northern Iraq, have begun to construct a military airport in Arbil, while a smaller military airfield will be established in Suleymaniyah. Companies close to the Turkish army are providing technical material for the bases, with container loads of building supplies being transported into northern Iraq through the Habur border gate crossing. Operations currently carried out from the U.S. military base and airfield at Incirlik in southern Turkey will reportedly be transferred to the Arbil base upon its completion. So if the Turks kick them out, they get to go into the Kurds area as the country falls apart. Bush says he may ignore new war funding law. This is by William Matthews. Congress said it wants next year's defense budget to include funding for the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, but President Bush has indicated he may ignore that request. In a signing statement released when he signed the 2007 Defense Authorization Act on October 17th, the president listed 24 provisions in the act that he indicated he may or may not abide by. Among the provisions is Section 1008 of the Authorization Act, which requires the president to submit defense budgets for 2008 and beyond that include funding for the wars and contain a detailed justification of the funds requested. The Bush administration has frequently ignored requirements that it does not like by proclaiming exclusions from the law in signing statements, which are written statements about how the president plans to interpret the law. Since he became president, Bush has issued statements carving out exceptions to more than 750 laws, a rate far higher than any previous president. Senator Carl Levin, Democrat of Michigan, said he would not be surprised if Bush ignores the budgeting requirements spelled out in Section 1008. I'm very dubious he will abide by it. He has ignored it before, the senior Democrat on the Senate Armed Services Committee said. during an October 18th press conference. Levin said the measure was a strong bipartisan statement that Congress wants responsible budgeting. He said that the administration has made a practice of irresponsible budgeting for the war since it began in 2003. The wars have been paid for through emergency spending bills and bridge funds that amount to about $450 billion so far. Some constitutional scholars say Bush may be on solid legal ground if he refuses to send Congress a defense budget that includes war funding, a congressional staffer said. The scholars argue that the Constitution does not give Congress the authority to tell the president what to request or how to request it. The staffer said past presidents have rightfully rejected provisions in which Congress has required the president to include specific amounts of money for specific weapons. I am not surprised that Bush may be resisting the demand to include war funding in the regular defense budget, but this is a kind of wimpy signing statement, he said. What does it mean? Lawmakers and their advisors were still trying to determine what it means the day after Bush issued it, he said. The statement says, quote, several provisions of the act call for executive branch officials to submit to the Congress recommendations for legislation or purport to regulate the manner in which the president formulates recommendations to the Congress for legislation. It goes on to say, the executive branch shall construe these provisions in a manner consistent with the president's constitutional authority to supervise the unitary executive branch and to recommend for the consideration of the Congress such measures as the president deems necessary and expedient. Congressional aides say that appears to mean the president will decide whether or not he must comply with the provisions. Basically, what the administration is saying to Congress is, you told us what you want, and now we're going to tell you what we're going to do, said Christopher Hellman, director of the Project on Military Spending Oversight. The congressional staffer said a number of members of Congress are going to be quite unhappy if money for the wars is not included in the budget. An amendment requiring war funding to be included in the regular defense budget, introduced by Senator John McCain, Republican of Arizona, was approved 99-0 by the Senate in July. It was accepted by the House in September. This is the same Senate that voted 100-0 for the war budget about 3 weeks ago, for the, what, $87 billion emergency bill for Iraq. So, in essence, Bush is saying, well, what if they want to hold Bush back on these emergency bills, they're going to have to stop voting them through, aren't they? They're saying, please, please, put it in the regular defense appropriation. And the reason they want that, a key congressional complaint about war funding through supplementals and bridge funds, which is what Bush has been doing for the last $450 billion, is that lawmakers see far fewer details about how the money will be spent, and supplementals must be approved by appropriations committees, but not by authorizing committees. Regular defense budgets must be approved by both. So that's the statement. And here's what I promised earlier about what the how the media has been treating what some call the torture law, what some call the military commissions law, what I call the suspension of the Constitution law. Actually, the Constitution was suspended some years ago in terms of its the rights of people being held who are foreign nationals or even U.S. citizens without held indefinitely with no trial. I think we have yet to see a meaningful trial of any of these people. There was a John Lind was never tried. He pled. Jose Padillo is still awaiting trial. Hamdi is I think he was deported. These people are held for years and years and years with no trial, and nobody gives a shit, including me, apparently. So here's what editor and publisher writer James Bovard says. How to make a power grab mundane. The Washington Post story today, Bush signs terrorism measure, looks like just another routine report on the approval of a piece of legislation accompanied by the usual he said, she said quotes. A typical reader might shrug at this point and shift to the sports section to read the latest autopsy on the Redskins. How will we know when a dictatorship has arrived? Not from reading the Washington Post. The Post story today, Bush signs terrorism measure, looks, as I said, like the routine report on the approval of a piece of legislation accompanied by the usual balancing quotes. The Military Commissions Act, which is the bill he signed on the 17th, is widely seen as legalizing torture, but the article avoids any mention of the T word. Though the act revolutionizes American jurisprudence by permitting the use of tortured confessions in judicial proceedings, the Post discreetly notes only that defendants will face restrictions on their ability to exclude evidence gained through witness coercion.
How's that for sweet double talk? The lead of the Post article declares that the new law will set the rules for the trials of key Al-Qaeda members. A typical Subway strap hanger reader might shrug at this point and shift to the sports section. The Post neglects to mention that the bill codifies the president's power to label anyone on earth an enemy combatant based on secret evidence which the government need not disclose. The Post mentions new restrictions on detainees' abilities to challenge their incarceration. The article neglects to add, until hell freezes over. Senator Arlen Specter characterized the bill's suspension of habeas corpus, which is your right to say, what the hell am I being charged with, Judge? Why am I here? And to require the police to take you into court within 48 hours to have that question answered, as akin to turning back the clock 800 years. But according to the Post, this reform is simply another provision and just another bill, and anyhow, so many bills get signed this time of year. The Post says nothing about how the new law makes the president legislator, prosecutor, judge, and bailiff. As Yale law professor Jack Balkin notes, the president has created a new regime in which he is a law unto himself on issues of prisoner interrogations. He decides whether he has violated the law, and he decides whether to prosecute the people he in turn urges to break the law. The torturers, in other words. The people who picked people up in foreign countries, held them, sent them to Syria to be tortured month after month after month. The tone of the Post article is akin to a bored broadcaster's reading from the teleprompter. In other news today, the government announced that the price of gasoline will be reduced by 7 cents a gallon and also suspended the Bill of Rights. The Military Commissions Act is a stark power grab, but one would never know it from the Post's account, nor from the San Jose Mercury News' account, nor from the San Francisco Chronicle's account, which quote the L.A. Times, by the way. I didn't read the Post account. I did read those two papers, which I simply take the L.A. Times story and talk about. This is really a measure that helps the president try the enemy combatants from Al-Qaeda that couldn't be tried because the Supreme Court overturned his, I set up my own secret military commissions and try them by my own rules, and said instead Congress had to weigh in. Congress weighed in, saying, go ahead, set up your own secret military commissions and do them according to pretty much your own rules. They added a few requirements, but not much. You know, there's no limit to how long a person can be held. There's no provision to be able to have an independent judicial review. There's no restriction on this coerced testimony. There's no restriction on hearsay testimony. There's no requirement that you be allowed to see the evidence against you. There's no requirement you be told the charges against you. Until they try you, and they never have to try you. It's incredible. At some point, it is conceivable that the U.S. government's repression could become more overt, and how would the Washington Post likely cover that? Well, here's an example. As U.S. Army tanks rolled through the streets of Washington, the D.C. police chief reported that the robbery rate fell 27.5%. National Guard units fired on demonstrators on Pennsylvania Avenue yesterday, damaging 2 Starbucks restaurants and 7 newspaper vending machines. The president announced that he has the right to wiretap anyone's phones. Wait, this example doesn't work. The president already did that earlier this year, so it's no longer news. And most of the media swallowed dutifully and deferred when the president relabeled the spying as the terrorist surveillance program. Amusingly, on the same page, A4, just below the article on the Military Commissions Act, the Post has a Washington and brief snippet entitled Bush Signs Defense Bill with Some Reservations. The Post account notes that when Bush signed the $532.8 billion military appropriations bill, he included a long list of caveats. Bush's signing statement singled out about a dozen provisions that would require the White House, and we talked about this in the other article, to provide Congress with information on various subjects. Bush reminded lawmakers of the president's constitutional authority to withhold information. The president proclaims his right to violate laws by denying Congress information on what the U.S. military is doing, and the Post draws no inference on how the powers conveyed by the Military Commissions Act could be used. Bush has added more than 800 signing statements to new laws since he took office. He is the first to use signing statements routinely to nullify key provisions of new laws. And I've also often wondered whether that's actually happened in terms of provisions actually being ignored, not just he said he was going to ignore them. And the critics have never been clear on that in terms of seeing that specifically with respect to any of those 800 signing statement exceptions that he's made. The American Bar Association recently declared that Bush's signing statements are contrary to the rule of law and our constitutional separation of powers, but the Washington Post portrays the signing statements as simply a gentlemanly difference of opinion between the president and congressman. It neglects to mention that the president now claims boundless prerogative to what is the law. And that is how the Washington Post and much of the establishment media portray almost every government seizure of power. It is never a question of looming tyranny. Instead, it is only a question of different perspectives and how best to serve the American public. Waiting for the Washington press corps to sound the alarm on Leviathan is like waiting for Bush to renounce his love of power. It's by James Bovard, author of Attention Deficit Democracy and other books. He's written for the Boston Globe, LA Times, American Conservative, and many other publications. That's off of antiwar.org. So that's about it for Bathrop Spears Broadsides tonight. Thank you very much for listening. If you have listened either to this online or in archive, call in at a time in the future when you can actually be on the air, or you can catch me off air at 831-423-HUFF, 423-4833. Thanks for being with me on this edition of Bathrop Spears Broadsides.
And the flag-draped coffins are a-sailing home, and the waves are watching as the engine draws. As the ship draws near, hear the bugle maul, the sad and silent song of a soldier with a hero's greeting. We will welcome him with a hero's speeches. We will honor him with a hero's ending. We will bury him. That's the sad and silent song of a soldier. And comfort his family with a telegram. We regret to inform you we have lost a man, but we gave him the highest medal of the land. That's the sad and silent song of a soldier. We know what an awful price he had to pay, but the enemy was contained for another day. We trained him well, he would have wanted it that way. That's the sad and silent song of a soldier. Oh, the weary wounded, they wait by his side, wondering why they hadn't also died. The picture of patriotic pride. That's the sad and silent song of a soldier. And the flag is at half-mast, wet with foreign rain, ignored by the strangers he had helped to train. To him it was duty, to them again. That's the sad and silent song of a soldier. At Arlington he's lowered down without a pause, and his native land welcomes him with open jaws. And the tombstone reads, such a noble cause. That's the sad and silent song of a soldier. Now a moment of silence for the broken man, while the president proudly crows, we'll never bend. and cheers the replacements marching off again. That's the sad and silent song of a soldier, and the flag-draped coffins are a sailing home, and the waves are watching as the engine draws, as the ship draws near, hear the bugle maw. The sad and silent song of a soldier. Come get out of the way, boy.
And welcome to Free Radio 101.1, where you won't hear me, but you can hear something else going on at 101.1. And, of course, if you're hearing my voice, you're tuned on the Internet to www.freakradio.org or you're listening in at radio.indymedia.org, a couple of places you can find free radio on the Internet. I'm Uncle Dennis. Be here for the next 3 hours playing music of the 60s and 70s, the name of the show, From the Cream to the Dregs. And we're going to get right back into the music here. Coming up 9 o'clock, the Earth First Update, and then it'll just be music on to the end. No mystery group tonight because of the broadcast outage, but we will be playing music, as always, from the 60s and the 70s. Stay tuned.
Light through the skies, voices keep calling. Bidding me welcome, white lady lands. Luring me closer, forbidden land. And as I'm standing closer, those men set me on. Release from mortal patterns, my mind now goes beyond. Spinning in circles, miracles happen. As Lorelei shows me to my doom, fear has been stricken, the end will come soon. This is termination.